like to call the Senate Education Committee to order. Our business of the day is to be inspired and challenged by our speaker, Dr. Tom Vander Ark, and we welcome here to Minnesota. I think we sent around a bit of his credentials. You were the first. Why don't you come to the table? And you've been executive director of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and you now have launched into your own enterprise of Open Ed Solutions that I think is a wave of the future that I think we need to know and understand if we don't already, but to envision what it might mean for some of the goals that we're trying to attain in our education system and with education policy. So welcome, Dr. Vander Ark, to our education committee. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we move to this presentation, I just wanted to ask you a question. I know that some of us are just eager to have a hearing from at the committee with some of our bills, but we've been told that we may not have the time to do this, that you might not have the time to have hearings for us. And, we were hoping that today we will have a hearing in one or two of the bills, but apparently the entire afternoon is going to be dedicated to this. And could we have these presentations after session? Is there any way we can have these bills heard?
We're doing this one now, but we also, none of the bills that have been introduced this session are, they're alive through the interim and through next year. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't necessarily mean that we aren't going to have continued work on it. But we've done things, we've had a different order of things this year of attempting and needing to put our budget bill out first and then policy following it. And that's what we've had to do. So, and this week we were only hearing bills that had passed the Senate or passed the House and needed to have a hearing in the Senate, and there weren't any that had that. So this was not a week that we could hear and initiate Senate bills and have them progress at all because of not having been heard or considered in the House.
Madam Chair, if I may, I just would like to ask for your support in trying to get some bills that may not pass, but our intent would be to educate the public about what we want to do. Some of the bills are very related to bills that have been heard, about charter schools, about teacher evaluation, for instance, where we have some differences of opinion, yet we look forward to build bipartisan support on those areas. I very much want to be able to work with other members in building really a future for moving forward education bills, which has been the tradition of this particular committee, and really working together to build bipartisan support. And sometimes, as you know, like the alternative teacher licensure, it takes years to build that. It takes years of education and bringing people to our, different districts so that they can learn about our experiences. And even though we may not have the votes for the minority, I think that the value of educating the public and educating other members is very real. And I would very much appreciate your support in bringing those bills to the committee for a hearing so that we're all able to kind of hear and find out how we can build bipartisan support.
Well, thank you for raising that issue. You know that when we began in the time that we were on, I made no commitments that I was going to hear every bill, but it doesn't mean, I think there are some bills that we haven't heard that are on topics related to what we're considering, like for example, Senator Sieben's bill on evaluation. We will be drawing from that bill in the dialogue and discussion in trying to reach compromise, because even the House and the Senate aren't quite on the same page on that. Mm-hmm. Recognizing the governor's support for this, we're not going to rule things like that out. So,
great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. Dr. Vander Ark.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and Senators. It's a pleasure to be with you. Good to be back in Minnesota. When I had the opportunity to help the Gates Foundation launch in 1999, a number of people told me that I had to visit Minnesota first. It was a place where there was a lot of innovation occurring, and I had on my first trip the chance to visit with a couple folks that are here, Ted Coldery and Doug Thomas. So I appreciate the history of innovation and education that's here, and look forward to a discussion about how we can make it better together. I have three parts to the presentation that I'd like to make. The first is a quick overview of the transformative potential of personal digital learning, and why I think it's such an important historic shift. The second is how most kids will learn using digital technology, and it's in schools that incorporate it into a physical setting. I call that blended learning. And then we'll close with about 5 minutes of a summary of policy advice for policymakers called Digital Learning Now, a report that Governor Bob Weiss and Jeb Bush, a process that they chaired and released on December 1st. Feel free to stop at any point. Happy to take comments or questions. Just a little background on me. I spent almost 15 years in the private sector, finance and engineering sort of background. Through a quirk in history, had the opportunity to become a public school superintendent, a district that was looking for some non-traditional leadership. That was a steep learning curve and a mostly wonderful experience. And then had the chance to help Bill and Melinda start the Gates Foundation. And all those 30 years have given me these conclusions. One is we can't reform our way to all kids college ready, that the schools that we have just aren't set up to help all kids leave prepared for college careers and citizenship. So I really believe that innovation is going to play an important role to producing excellence and equity. And I've also come to the conclusion, having worked with about 400 nonprofits and hundreds of school districts, that the private sector is going to play an important role in producing and scaling innovation, and that the challenges that we face are big enough that we need to work together. We need the private sector, the philanthropic sector, and the public sector to build partnerships that produce a better delivery system for kids and families. So in this decade, we'll live through what I think is the most pivotal shift in human history. Sounds melodramatic, but the shift from print to digital and from age cohorts of kids in a classroom to individuals learning at their own pace in their own way is such an important shift. I really think it's one of the most important trends in the world right now. I wrote a blog last week called 8 Megatrends That Are Shaping Human History, and personal digital learning is high on the list. This is how America will improve its schools, and it is how we will reach the next billion young people around the world. So you get the sense that I think this is a big deal. Here's the three reasons that I think it's so important. Customization, motivation, and equalization. By customization, I mean creating instructional programs, a series of instructional experiences for every student that are just right for them, at the right level, at the right pace, in the right mode, at the right time, at the right place. We can now customize the learning experience for every kid. And there's a lot of commentators that think that will be more productive than how we organize schools today, which is in a age cohort where a teacher teaches a basic curriculum and then administrators like me say, differentiate, meet everyone's needs. Well, even the best teacher is challenged to meet the needs of kids in classrooms where they're often 5 or 6 years difference in their literacy and numeracy skills. So customization, I believe, will result in more learning per hour. If we do a better job of tailoring the learning experience for every kid, I think we'll see students learn more per hour. What will drive this is a smart learner profile, capturing lots of data about students. And then I think the most interesting breakthrough of this decade will be really deep understanding of motivational profiles, a better understanding of what the hook is, what will get your attention, what will get your son or daughter's attention, and then what will help them persist through difficult work, to stick with it. I think we'll customize learning in lots of different ways. I've listed 10 right here, and many of those will show up in what School of One, a very interesting math pilot in New York City, has begun calling a playlist. We think of a playlist like something on our MP3 player, but kids at School of One have a playlist, and I think most of our kids will have a playlist when they go home. Homework will be a playlist that will say, play this math game, experience this a virtual environment, and take this quiz online. So we'll be able to customize a playlist for every student, but we'll also, as is common at Minnesota New Country and Doug's and schools in the EdVisions network, we can customize a lot of their experience through projects and internships. Motivation. The folks that have really gained understanding in the field of motivation in the last 10 years are the casual game developers. They're really good at this. And it's the secret is calibration. Now, part of it is having an engaging game experience and cool characters, but the real secret is calibration, making the game just hard enough, not too hard. But it's that, it's the calibration that makes it challenging but not too challenging that is why maybe some of you keep playing Angry Birds and games like that. And I think we'll get a lot smarter in this decade about building persistence and leveraging the interests that kids bring to school. Here's an example of a company that I found in London and made a small investment in last year called Manga High. It's a middle grade math game company. They've got 8 beautiful games that are built around the mechanics of mathematics. And they students will get lots of instant feedback as they're playing these games. And then the teachers get a dashboard that shows how each student is progressing. So a good example of adaptive and engaging content. Last point, equalization. It's really providing access. So one-to-one technology, whether it's a laptop or a netbook or a tablet, is going to provide a number of benefits. One is that it will help extend learning 24/7, 365, and as we shift from print to digital instructional materials, it will give every student access to high-quality content. It will give every student, where states allow it, access to really good teachers. So the benefit here is more quality learning hours per year. So to summarize why I'm excited about personal digital learning, it's more learning per hour, more hours per day, and more days per year. So longer day, longer school year, delivered less expensively by combining online and on-site. There's a report that the full-length report just came out yesterday called The Rise of Blended Learning by the InnoSight Institute. It's Michael Horn was the co-author with Clay Christensen of Disrupting Class. And this is really the best and most up-to-date summary of new learning formats that in productive ways combine online and on-site learning. So the definition that I have developed for blended learning I think is important, and this is how it's different than education technology. When I was a superintendent, I added laptop programs to all my schools in 1995, and it was cool, but it just sort of layered technology on top of how we had always done things. So it took the old model and made it slightly cooler, but made it more expensive. The blended learning is different because it's a shift in learning to for at least a portion of the day, to an online environment, and that shift is made to improve learning and to improve operating productivity. In other words, there is an intentional effort to rethink the school staffing to leverage the technology so that it works better for teachers and for kids. So this report outlines six different ways that schools are combining online and on-site learning. If you want more information, just Google the rise of blended learning and take a look at some of those case studies. But here's a quick description or picture of the kinds of blends that I think are going to be really exciting. If we take the playlist idea from School of One, so a customized series of learning experiences targeted at individual student needs and interests and learning levels, and we combine that with the best in experiential learning, like expeditionary learning or Minnesota New Country. So you take really rich, engaging, community-connected learning, and you combine the power of technology, that's the potential that's right in front of us, to make school powerful, personal, productive experience for every student. So let me transition to the policy section in conclusion with this thought experiment. And this is part of why I'm enthusiastic about personal digital learning. The punchline is the first time we have a scalable solution, a massively scalable solution. If you or if Arne Duncan with the chief state school officers wanted to organize summer school for every kid in America, in about 60 days, the top six or seven online learning providers could provide summer school for every kid in America that was interested. All AP, all foreign language, and they could deliver it less expensively with consistent quality than anybody could imagine doing in a traditional way. So I'm just trying to illustrate that we finally have a bunch of large, capable, nonprofit and for-profit entities that are serving millions of kids in America and that they can quickly address the needs of more students and do it very rapidly. The only thing that's standing in the way is local and state policy. So given that barrier, I visited with Jeb Bush in June of last year, and he said, "Tom, I think I share your passion for the potential of digital learning, but I think we need to boil it down for state policymakers and create a framework for how to incorporate the power of digital learning." And I described another Minnesota-centered initiative called the Data Quality Campaign, and Amy Gandera. And I said that was, as a grant maker, that was probably one of the most productive grants that I made to the DQC. And it took about 3 years, but it took all the sector policy groups and moved them along to create a national understanding of the key elements of state data systems. Doesn't sound very, very interesting, but it was a very important development. So I described that to Governor Bush, and he said, "That's great. I want to do the same thing in about 90 days because we have 27 new governors starting, and we need to find a way to give people advice quickly." So we developed a plan. We asked Governor Bob Weiss, a former governor from West Virginia, who now leads a great high school advocacy group in Washington, D.C., called the Alliance for Excellent Education. The two of them invited 100 experts from around the country, and in 100 conferences and in about 100 days, they developed a report called Digital Learning Now, available at digitallearningnow.com. Here's the 10 elements in the three-minute version. First of all, the report suggests that we view all kids as digital learners and that we give all students access to high-quality digital learning. The report also encourages states to do what the House and Senate just did in Florida yesterday, what Michigan and Arkansas do, which is require all students to take at least one online course while they're in high school. I think you could easily justify one each year. The main rationale that I would use for that is that all kids are going to learn online once they leave high school, whether it's in a post-secondary setting or in the military, which happens to be the smartest learning organization on the planet, or in a work setting. All kids are going to learn online. They should start it while they're in high school. The report also suggests multiple providers, multiple statewide providers, and giving kids and families a choice to the course level. The report stresses how important it is for the state to hold accountable providers using a process like the one recommended by NACSA, the National Charter School Authorizers. And I know you're doing some work with that group here on your new authorizing strategy. So using those kinds of performance contracting approaches to do a thorough job of reviewing statewide providers and allowing them to earn the right to continue to serve kids if they do it really well. And then finally, funding and delivery. It's time as state leaders to plan the shift to digital learning. You need to for a couple reasons. One is the state assessment consortia will incorporate a good deal of online learning. That will require you to have a high access plan in place not later than 2014 so that you can assess every student. In other words, most of your state testing system is very likely to be online 3 years from now, and so you will need to work with your Department of Education and your school districts to develop a plan for how students will be assessed, and whether it will be in a lab setting or on a mobile device or a combination of the two, but Minnesota will need a plan for how that happens. I think you can use that opportunity as a shift to from print to digital instructional materials. And student devices are becoming inexpensive enough that I think you can actually give kids a netbook or a tablet and save money in shifting from print to digital.
Do you object to taking some questions along
the
way?
No, I'm done. Oh. I think that's it, and happy to stop there. I'll tell one quick story and then take any questions. This is a school in Kibera. It's a slum around Nairobi. And these kids go to a school where the tuition's about $40 a year. They're getting urban American results in terms of literacy and numeracy. And my goal in the second half of this decade is to make sure that they have a great high school. And I think we can do that with broadband and inexpensive tablets and open education resources. And it's going to transform villages like this one, and I think it can have the same sort of transformational potential here. Thanks.
Senator Wigger.
Yes, thanks. Madam Chair and Dr. Vander Ark, could you comment further on the global rollout of digital learning, blended learning, and particularly in those countries like Finland or China, Korea, where they are looked at as exemplary?
Dr. Vander Ark.
China and India, if you think about their populations, India has about 950 million young people. The only conceivable way to reach that population, particularly at the secondary level, is with low-cost blended learning. Their government is very interested in digital learning. The same is definitely true in China, where they've already announced plans to extend digital learning to another 100 million young people. So they clearly understand the potential, but they also understand that they couldn't take a school system like we have in the U.S. and replicate it because of the cost. They will need to find ways to educate thousands of kids for something between $100 and $1,000 a year, not the $10,000 that we spend. So I think they are very bullish on the potential for low-cost blended learning.
Senator Bono.
Madam Chair, Dr. Vander Ark, I'm very interested in this area as well. I represent a district, Minnetonka School District. They received one of two awards in the country for the use of technology to accelerate student learning, teaching and learning.
Right.
And the thing that impresses me most about what they're doing is they're using the individual technology tools, like the little handheld devices,
right,
to shape these individual learning plans, because then the teacher sees where each student is on various, you know, you ask a question, the teacher instantly has them press their little thing and sees where they are, and can then shape the instructional learning and, you know, you go here, you go here. In addition, the use of integrating the smart board system with how they teach has students highly engaged. Now, that is a little bit different because it's not necessarily low cost. It's differentiated, and
right,
it's using technology in the classroom in that way. So when you say blending, do you also mean that kind of blending?
I would call that interesting and potentially productive uses of education technology, but not necessarily blended learning. So the additional piece, and often let me make the connection with School of One. So what you've described, it sounds like a cousin of School of One, where they're trying to develop interesting uses of technology that may boost achievement for students. So once you have a strategy for doing that, the next step that is critical now in this new normal period where we have to find ways to do more with less would be to think about how that technology would allow you to change the staffing patterns at that school. Mm-hmm. So when people ask me where to start with blended learning, I think 612 math is a great place to do a blended learning pilot, whether it's a middle school or a high school or a 612 school. And so let me describe what that would look like. It, instead of having individual classrooms with individual courses, every student would learn online. Every student would progress at their own pace. You would have I would call it a differentiated and distributed staffing model, which means you probably have one. If it's a middle school, let's say you'd have one master teacher that might work with two junior teachers, and they may have two or three lab assistants that work with them. So instead of, let's say that middle school had four teachers originally that had 150 students each, you would shift to three teachers, sort of master teacher plus two, that would have class loads of about 200 kids. So it's a larger class size, but because kids are doing more autonomous and asynchronous learning online, it actually gives the teachers more time to spend with either individual students or groups of students that need help. Mm-hmm. Here's a quick story from School of One, which is this really cool individualized math program in New York City. Most students will have at least part of their day, a double block. Part of that time they'll spend in a small group instruction with a teacher. But here's the neat thing about that experience for the kids and the teacher. When the teacher prepares for the lesson, they know that every student in their group is ready for that lesson that day. It's the right lesson at the right level, at the right time, in the right mode for that student. That's a real gift for teachers to have that sort of scheduling. So instead of teaching a lecture to 25 or 30 kids in a classroom, knowing that it's the right lesson in the right way for a few kids, but knowing that some kids are bored because they're advanced and some kids are checked out because they're so far behind. So a program like School of One creates this dynamic scheduling where it allows small group instruction tailored for the needs of individual kids. So that's an example of how you can use technology to increase the student load, but do it in a way that teachers actually have more time to spend with individual students. So you can, that's an example of a staffing pattern that may save a school a little bit of money and would probably work better than a traditional math course or a math program.
Senator Baca.
Madam Chair, follow up then. So in that particular instance, is that because the data is so sophisticated that as the students are doing their online learning and we're getting where each student is, then
right.
that funnels up to, okay, students who are here, they get scheduled in this way?
Right.
Is that how that works?
Yeah, so every student is moving at their own pace, and it may be entirely online or it may be a mixture of learning online and learning in small groups. So This report would show a variety of examples of what that might look like. Another example of a great place to start advice you could give school districts here would be advanced placement courses. You know, your Department of Education could put out an RFP and ask for folks that teach RFP. They could buy a block of AP courses, offer those to districts. Districts could go from offering a couple AP courses to all 32 and save money doing it. And if you wanted them to, they could all be Minnesota teachers delivering those courses. But another example where you can increase access, ensure consistent level of quality, and probably save the state and school districts money.
Senator Rieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And should these programs, the technology be rolled out in preschool?
Yes.
And some specific examples showing the higher productivity, the objectives that you said, and where you also save money?
I don't know much about that subject. I'd have to say I spend almost all of my time thinking about and working on secondary schools and couldn't give you a good specific example of preschool, but I do, from what I see and read about young kids and using mobile learning applications, I'm certainly bullish about that and think in either a formal setting of a preschool or an informal setting at home that a portion of a student day using mobile learning devices can be a great thing. I would add that it's really important for parents to monitor student time online. That's been true of television, and it's even more true of time online. But parents that pay attention, I think, can really do a lot with these mobile apps to boost learning in young kids.
Madam Chair, and I totally agree in the role of the parents and the supervision, but that's where it's at, the digital learning for preschoolers as well, and I had a great time with my preschool grandchildren, with their iPads, and they
right.
are much quicker, can respond much faster than adults.
There clearly has to be ways to boost the vocabulary of low-income kids, right? This is the big bugaboo. When you kids come to kindergarten, these dramatic differences in vocabulary. That's the beginning of the achievement gap, and we should be able to put a big dent in that problem using these mobile learning applications.
Senator Nelson. Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Vander Ark, it's great to hear you again. Since I first heard you speak in Chapel Hill, I was glad to come home and find that one of my school districts recently just decided to get netbooks for, I can't remember how many classes or how many of their, but it was in the middle school level.
Good.
And my question is, so they and others may have gotten the hardware, so to speak, but I'm just wondering what type of resources are there, and are they plentiful, so that school districts that have taken this leap can actually access the resources to make these work?
Sort of.
And where would they find them?
It's a great question. Let me answer it this way. We're at a wonderful, frustrating period in history where I think of it as the end of the first generation of online learning. So I started the first online learning school in the country, first K-12 online school in 95. And they haven't progressed all that much. They're still... A lot of static content, and in most of the online schools, it's still kind of a one-way slog through digital content, sort of digital textbooks. So you can vary rate and location and time, but not so much path. So what's really exciting are some of the personalized applications that I described, Manga High, and some of the social learning applications like Edmodo. It's like a Facebook for schools. So when you see those components, you can imagine the potential. However, it's safe to say that it's still difficult to stitch these components together. The same can be said for open education resources. So there's a lot of good free content out there. Teachers find it often difficult to locate and to manipulate. So I'm very encouraged by the platforms that will be developed and introduced in the next 18 months, but it is for the next year or two, there'll be some frustration of either adopting a set of applications that feel a bit dated but all work together really well, or picking a set of applications that are really promising and very engaging, but don't work together as well. Those are your sort of choices today, and those choices are going to get a lot better. But it is, you know, the point is we've passed this cost threshold where a netbook is so inexpensive that you really can't justify not giving kids netbooks now. You can't justify the traditional backpack full of textbooks when you can put a netbook and digital content, including some open content, in front of every student. That opportunity set and cost are so attractive now. It is time to make the shift.
Senator Nelson. Thank you, Member. Just to follow up, and my concern is that a number of these districts are taking this leap. They're getting the netbooks, which I applaud wholeheartedly. And yet I'm concerned because I know they're pilot projects.
Right.
And so without the online content and the personalized content, it might be harder for those pilot projects then to be rolled out district-wide if they don't have the open source or the content that's necessary.
Well, there's a lot of very good content and very good free content. An example would be Hippocampus. Hippocampus.org from the National Repository of Open Content is a 6 through 12 math and science curriculum that's very good. I would stack it up against any proprietary content, and with Gates from Hewlett and the Gates Foundation continues to get better. So, I'm not certain what they're doing with those in the pilot project, but there is very good content. It's situation's improved a lot since 95 when I did my first one-to-one implementation. I think the point is districts need to be really thoughtful about the transition. I will say it's not easy. To make the transition, you need a good academic plan, a financial plan, a safety and security plan. You need a communication plan for your both internal and external. And you need a policy and a policy plan, particularly to shift to competency-based learning. So there are a lot of dimensions that you need to cover to make a shift that will ensure that it really does work better for students and teachers.
Sarah Bonner.
Madam Chair, when Senator Nelson mentioned that, it occurred to me that some of the discussions we're having here around the Common Core standards. I'm a fan of the Common Core standards because I think it gives us an opportunity to move more quickly towards this kind of curriculum, but there's been a lot of resistance from both parties here at the legislature. I would say more people are not for it than for it because of concerns around local control, maintaining independence. We in Minnesota pride ourselves on having the highest standards. So could you address your thoughts on that issue?
Sure.
Dr. Andrew.
I am I'm a generally a fan of the Common Core and think the shift to common standards is a very important step for America. It will end a bit of the race to the bottom problem that we had over the last 10 years where states were lowering their standards and where very few states really had college-ready college and career ready standards. So I guess two thoughts. One is I think the real question will be answered with the assessments that are going to be produced by the two state consortia. So the Race to the Top produced two consortia, $365 million split between these two consortia to help develop new assessments. And those assessments are what will frame American education for the next decade. So they'll clearly be better than what most states had. I am concerned that they won't be as good as they should be. So I think we all need to be vigilant about those assessments in the next 120 days. It'd be good to ask your chief about those every month for the next six, because it's a very formative period of time that will shape the next decade of American education. The big benefit to the core will be that content providers will now be able to plan for a common set of standards instead of trying to map to 50 different standards. So what I think that means is that we'll see more investment in content and related instructional materials and tools, and that will produce much better curriculum, these big libraries of really engaging content, games and simulations and virtual environments around the Common Core. So, and this is not all just for profit. It's the big nonprofit with the support of foundations are going to help produce really interesting content around the Common Core. So it does give this sort of national spine that's going to unleash, I think, a lot of investment and a lot of innovation. And that'll be a very good thing for America.
Any other questions? Have you stumped us? Have you stumped us all? Senator Wicker.
Yes, Madam Chair, Doctor, could you talk about a state that is strapped on resources like most? You talked about how we would save money, increase productivity. How do you book that necessarily and rolling out for all districts?
Dr. Andrew.
I have to go now. that's the tough question that every state is trying to answer. So not an easy answer, but I can say with confidence that if you develop a thoughtful planning process with your state education authority, and if they engage school districts, that you can develop a multi-year plan where you can have an orderly transition to digital learning and one-to-one access environments and shift from print to digital and shift from age cohorts to competency-based learning. Like I said, that's a complicated shift. But if let's say you pick August of 2012 as the day that you want to transition, maybe you transition your secondary schools and then you transition your elementary schools the following year. But picking these dates, these pivot points, will help this body and your state education department and your districts make some budgeting decisions about how students are going to be provided with technology. They can transition their print curriculum budget to digital curriculum, and they can begin thinking differently about staffing patterns in schools. One I think important step in this sort of direction would be to make sure that there are a handful of pilots launched, maybe starting even summer school, that demonstrate how you can do things differently. And then make sure that there's a number of districts this fall that have, where you have a 612 math pilot, a blended math pilot. Make sure that there's a bunch of districts that are doing all their upper division AP math and science online. That's another great place to demonstrate that you can improve choices for kids, have consistently high quality, and deliver it for less money. So a math pilot, probably an AP or and STEM pilot, and then maybe a handful of elementary pilots based on the rocket ship model. Rocket ship is the highest performing elementary schools in California, and they use a computer lab to be able to afford a long day and a long year and larger class sizes. And that model saves them about a half $1 million a year. You should have a handful of elementary schools that demonstrate that model. So a series of pilots that demonstrate the potential, and then a planning process with your state department and your districts can help orchestrate the shift from print to digital. So a lot to think about, but I can close this way. There's not another way that you can boost achievement and cut costs other than to find new ways to leverage the potential of instructional technology. I mean, the alternative is a worse version of our old school model, right, with bigger class sizes. Well, that nobody's happy with that, right? The teachers won't like that idea. It won't work well for kids, especially the ones that need more help. So I think this is the only opportunity that we have to both boost learning productivity and make our schools more sustainable.
Could you, you mentioned early in your presentation that there were the barriers of local and state policy. Could you elaborate on that in terms of what you see are some of the policy barriers that are in place that prevent this from happening?
So it's a long list, and the Digital Learning Now attempts to create a new framework. One specific answer is Christy and I could get back to you on that and give you a sort of a specific, here's what we think a good framework looks like, here's the three or four specific areas Minnesota could do better.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's one specific offer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'm the chair of the International Online Learning Association, and our top priority is competency-based learning. So there are a number of barriers to allowing kids to move at their own pace. So seat time requirements would be at the top of that list. Second would be testing systems that don't meet student needs. If we're going to encourage kids to move at their own pace, some faster, some slower, then we need a testing system that works at their pace, not at the end of the year. So seat time requirements and testing strategies for competency-based learning would be high on the list. And then I suspect there are a set of policies around curriculum and textbooks that you'd want to take a look at and revise those for with digital content in mind.
Senator Rieger,
yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just one final question. I assume there's multiple vendors. It's very competitive for these services. That's good. Do you know of any that will back their product by saying school district, you only have to pay half up front and the other half
yes.
or whatever, if we deliver on what we say we will?
Dr. Vander?
Yes, there are a few vendors that'll make that offer. The state of Utah just passed a bill that will result in a number of statewide online learning providers. It also implements performance-based funding. So performance-based funding means you get paid half up front and you get the other half if the student passes the course with an acceptable level of achievement. The only program that works that way at any scale now is Florida Virtual. Florida Virtual School is the country's largest state-run virtual. They have about 220,000 course enrollments every year. And that whole program is performance-based. They get half up front and about half when the student completes the course. And it's also year-round rolling enrollment. So when think about that from a competency-based standpoint, a kid can sign up at any point, start taking a course, and Florida Virtual gets an upfront payment, and then they only get paid on the back end. So Utah just adopted a similar bill, and I believe the bill just passed yesterday in Florida will extend that same kind of payment mechanism to other online providers in the state.
Thank you.
Great. Are there any other questions? Are there any members of the audience that would like to ask a few questions? You're welcome. You're welcome to come to the table and give your reflection or ask a question. If not, do I see something?
Yeah. Just to address the two.
Why don't you come to a mic? Why don't you go down to one of the mics at the table?
I'll just say that I mentioned Governor Jeb Bush and his foundation, the foundation he chairs, Foundation for Excellent Education, has been the sponsoring entity for the Digital Learning Now project. So they have been a terrific partner in this effort.
Madam Chair, Christy Hovanitz from the Foundation for Excellence in Education. You had asked, and Tom and I can come back with a list of the things that are the major barriers, state and local barriers, but the two primary barriers that we've seen talking to other states with respect to state-level policies and what state legislatures have control over is the first one is teacher certification. Are teachers from the Florida Virtual School allowed to provide instruction in the state of Minnesota because of the reciprocity between teacher certification agreements? And the second thing we found is even within state is funding. So if Minnetonka is providing an online course, can somebody from the Osseo area schools take a Minnetonka course, and how does that funding stream work and get divided? So those are the two main policy considerations from the state level that we've encountered that legislatures can work through, and there's very easy ways to do it. It just takes some negotiating.
So if I can
yes.
just expand on that, this is the most challenging area. It'll be contentious politically, and it's difficult technically. But the Digital Learning Now report is really clear about the need to create choice to the course level with funding that follows the student. And ideally, that would be weighted student funding, so that a student that had a higher level of need would receive a higher level of funding. But at least fractional funding that supports multiple learning options.
You know, back in the days when I was studying school finance in graduate school, as I recall, Florida was the state that did have weighted pupil funding. Has that been a factor that has made it easier for them to enter the virtual education at the level that they're at now?
So I don't think there's weighted funding for virtual education.
But they had just a weighted pupil based on various needs for regular education. But I mean, they had that model, and I don't know if there was many. We have a school funding expert, John Myers, has joined us today, and welcome back to Minnesota. And he's nodding or correcting me by expression here. That is the concept that you're suggesting that would need to be developed to make the virtual education work,
right?
Or the funding for virtual education, okay. Or blended learning. I'm sorry, Senator Bonnoff.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for having this presentation today. I think as we look at our challenges going forward, when we do have metro schools that offer many different languages, and then we have outstate schools where they're lucky if they can get one language due to, you know, budget constraints, it does open up a world of opportunity if we can envision a system whereby they can all work together and take advantage of the assets that are unique to each. So, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that as we've been discussing some of the challenges in school funding, and particularly in sparse areas, and you propose how many school districts do we need, or how many governmental units? Well, if you talk about consolidating school districts, all you do is increase the length of the bus ride,
right,
to get to your place where you're educated. This concept can reverse that and make it possible to still stay connected with your school, but possibly in a different way, and have far more learning opportunities. So it does. It's intriguing as to what this might be able to do, in a variety of different ways.
Right.
So, I see. If there's no other, Dr. Radel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Vanderak, thank you for being here. For the record, Bob Wadle. One of the interesting characteristics about learning in school is that it doesn't count. Learning doesn't count until somebody gives it a grade and puts it on a transcript. Then it counts. Learning through technology or the digital learning has this huge, rich opportunities out there. So how do you count it? how can we put into place the validation systems? Now when a teacher reads Jen Olson's paper, it gets it an A+, of course. It counts. And I have validated it. So in this rich environment where probably more learning opportunities are available outside of the building than inside, how do we count it? How do we validate it?
I have thoughts on that.
Dr. Vanderart.
No, I actually think that's one of the most interesting questions in the world. And I don't think that question gets as much attention as it deserves. I'll give you an example. Saul Kahn is now the unlikely poster boy of digital learning. Saul was an investment fund, hedge fund manager that started tutoring his little cousin in 2006, and he made these really cool videos, and they went viral. And he said in 2009, "I think I'm going to quit my day job and actually do this thing." And he's now the probably the most important teacher in the world. He has hundreds of thousands of views of his Khan Academy videos every single day. He's now built a merit badge system that in an informal way certifies that a student has demonstrated competence. So the question is that should that be any less valuable than a grade on a quiz at school? We don't actually know the answer to that. It's fair to say that the virtual schools do a very good job of certifying student learning. The interesting thing is when you interview kids and teachers in a fully virtual setting, you find out that those are often much more personalized relationships and instructional experiences than they are in a traditional school. So there's at least as much, often more, data that goes with those relationships. What I'm really excited about is that in a year or two, our fifth graders are going to have 5,000 keystroke days, and our 10th graders are going to have 10,000 keystroke days, where they're all day long. They're getting tons of performance feedback. And I think for 90% of them, that's going to take place in a traditional school setting. So you will have the Khan Academy-like instant feedback from technology, and you'll have a teacher that's been able to monitor that process and put her stamp of approval on it. So the near-term answer is we're going to combine sort of the best of game-like feedback with teacher-certified feedback, and that's one of the magic things about blended learning. It is really a best of both worlds opportunity. But we should keep pushing on your question, because it will help us think more creatively about this thing called school, and the ultimate role of the state is to certify learning, and I think we can be more innovative about how that's done.
How do you see that interfacing or fitting with the Common Core standards and the assessments that are going to will be springing up to measure those? If you're looking at this kind of options for delivery, how will that?
Yeah, I'm very excited about an answer to this question. So I'm working on a merit badge platform. It's like the Scouts developed 100 years ago. I think they're really onto something. And the magic of a merit badge is that students can decide what to choose, what to work on, and then within a badge, there's some required elements and some optional elements, and it's clear what they need to learn. There's strategies for learning, and then different ways that they can demonstrate competence. So the platform that I'm working on assembles open content around the Common Core with multiple forms of assessment, some machine scored, some teacher scored. So each of those units is in effect certified both by a computer and a teacher that the student has mastered that content. So I think these smaller chunks of learning are going to be a much easier way to manage competency-based learning than the traditional school year and courses. That in small chunks, kids in multiple ways are going to be able to demonstrate that they have learned what the Common Core has asked of them. So I think you'll see some really exciting innovations in this space in the next year.
Just one quick comment, Madam Chair. Lawyer friends like Senator Wieger teach you never ask a question unless you already know the answer. Is that right, Senator Lawyer Wieger? Some of the work in this digital area is being done now and coming up with different ways to validate learning. For example, the different SATs and ACTs, learning is validated by a very credible organization, even though it's not in the school. Right. And I'm confident that people like you will be developing the validation packages to go along with the digital platforms to say, here is how you can validate this learning and get agreement with the teacher prior to that time, and then the teacher comes back and reviews that validation actually has occurred. So right. Those are some of the real exciting things that you're going to be doing for us in the future, and we look forward to it.
Great. Senator Wiegert.
Yes, and Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to this question, but I wanted to ask Mr. Myers, and it's an honor that you're here. You, for those that don't know, you did a rather in-depth study of Minnesota school finance midpoint in the last decade, and we're still studying it, but I'd love to get your feedback as you've been taking a lot of notes, but some suggestions on how we would seize the opportunity, the suggestions for the future as it relates to our own funding, if that's okay.
Now, that's not a question that goes with consulting fees, so you come up here. It's
gratis.
Madam Chair and
thank you. Welcome,
Senator
Dr. Meyer.
It's very interesting. I, in fact, on Monday in Colorado, am going to be facilitating a conversation among some of the folks that he's just mentioned to be able to think about whether or not a new school funding formula, how they would adopt some of these concepts. So I came here to learn. I will say, first of all, that our recommendation, our being Augenblick Palaisch and Associates' recommendation to that group, was to remember the first few questions that are really important. Right now, they are because ultimately this is a question about teaching and learning. It's about how you're going to evaluate learning, how kids are going to get that. But where we are on a state policy or local policy is our governance issues. And you shouldn't get confused with governance issues and learning issues, because governance issues are the questions about right now, although in Minnesota you don't fit the national example very well anymore, but it's about local property taxes and what role those local property taxes play and local decision-making around curriculum and instruction and what do they play. So those are the kinds of questions that when you're talking about a school finance formula, how you have to think about it to begin with, because school finance formulas are about making sure that the wealth of an individual community is not going to change how much is spent on kids. It's a wealth equalization plan more than it is a how do you go about teaching and learning plan that we've left up to local school districts in the past. So that's one of the first questions is the governance question. Other than that, I mean, again, as I just said, come Monday, I'm going to be working with some people in Colorado to try to think more about student learning-based school funding. And that's where the future is, I think, and that's what you've heard today.
Interesting. Thank you. Interesting convergence of presence. Thank you very much. Any other questions that have been triggered? If not, thank you very much, and thank you all for coming and listening, and I hope this has kind of sparked some thought. We've been trying to do that this session. We know there's lots of challenges that we face, but change is coming so fast, and sometimes innovation is going to happen in spite of us. And it doesn't hurt to get an idea of what, in fact, is happening out there. Some of us are more Luddites in technology. I finally at least got to a smartphone. But it's absolutely amazing what most of us have seen happen in our lifetime. And when you look at what the potential is of harnessing that for learning, when you were talking about, somebody was talking about working with preschool, I know people that go to their grandkids to have them help learn how to use whatever instrument that they have. Here's one. So they just take to it like ducks to water. They are the natives, and we are the immigrants. So, and yet we're the ones that are in the policy making and making some of these kinds of decisions. And so I think it's incumbent upon us to become knowledgeable and try not to be the barriers, but be the guides, if you will, to assure that good learning is going to take place and each child's needs are going to be met. So thank you, Dr. Van Der Ark. We really appreciate your giving us this time.
Thank you.
And thanks, members. The meeting is adjourned.
Okay.